See, that's exactly the kind of thing I mean.
Farley riposts, the whole room looking at him now.
We spent all our time congratulating ourselves on what a great school we are. We go into class every day and fill the kids' heads up with crap. But you try to say anything about what the world's actually, genuinely like, and someone will tell you to keep your mouth shut and show some respect.
You know what your problem is, Farley?
Tom raises his voice.
I don't know, Tom.
Farley raising his own right back.
What's my problem? Enlighten me.
Your problem is you're a knocker. You're a typical fucking Irish knocker. While decent people are putting their heads down and getting on with the job and doing the best they can, you hop about like a little bird, picking away at everything, chipping away at everyone's morale, because you're too spineless and selfish to try and make a difference.
You're totally right, Tom. You're absolutely right. I am spineless. I'm a spineless, selfish, useless person, and I don't do anything to try and make a difference. But you know what? Neither do you, and neither does anyone in this fucking place beyond the bare minimum. Instead, we just look after ourselves and the people like us, because we know that otherwise things might actually change.
Take it easy, Howard tells him. And when this has no effect, appeals to Tom, he's had a lot to drink.
Fuck off, Fallon, you're worse than he is.
Things might change,
Farley repeats, standing now with his arms outstretched.
We might even have to let strangers into our little treehouse. Poor people, foreign people. How'd you like that, Tom? How'd you like to see your precious school full of knackers and refugees?
At least it'd be better than faggots like you.
Boys, please.
Pleads Miss McSorley.
Oh, right, I'm a faggot now, am I?
Come on now, lads.
Slattery weighs in.
This isn't the time or the place.
I think you're the faggot.
Say that once more and I'll knock you down.
I think you're an Irish crazy homo. You're a flaming, mincing, fudge-packing queen, and all you think of from one end of the day to the next is boys in their pretty little swimming togs.
Tom lunges at Farley, but several men intervene to hold him back, and his punch fails to connect. It seems to waken Farley, however. He stares at Tom, his mouth open in surprise.
Come on, let's get out of here.
Howard tugs at his arm. While Tom wrestles with his captors, he hustles Farley out of the pub. The street outside is wintry and monochrome. Above, a blood-red sun flares through the clouds, like a last live coal uncovered among the cinderwork of the dying seasons. When they are a safe distance away, he turns on him.
What the fuck are you doing? What was the point of that?
I don't know, Howard.
Farley looks off bleakly at the sea.
It's just... they're just kids, you know? And the people who are supposed to be looking after them and teaching them about maturity and responsibility. We're worse than they are.
Howard pushes him away, grinds his teeth. They walk down to the main road, where after 5 minutes Howard manages to pluck a taxi from the traffic. He declines Farley's invitation to come back to his apartment and drink more. At home, there are no messages on his answering machine. He picks up Graves and numbly turns the pages. We no longer saw the war as one between trade rivals. Its continuance seemed merely a sacrifice of the idealistic younger generation to the stupidity and self-protective alarm of the elder. If someone had been looking out for that kid, this wouldn't have happened. According to the papers, Howard was the last adult to see Daniel Juster alive. Alive. In the rear-view mirror, merging with the dusk, as if he stood on the threshold right at that moment, a dark door Howard couldn't perceive. But how was he supposed to know? And even if he had known, what was he supposed to have done? Bring him home with him? Ditch his car and go and play with him in the freezing cold car park? That would somehow have made everything all right. Throwing around a frisbee like he was 14 years old? When was the last time he even played frisbee? But then, thinking about it, he realizes he remembers the last time quite clearly. And with a disarming vividness, finds himself not so much in the grip of a memory, as slipped back to that very time, to the shape and feel of being 14, the taste of apple-flavored bubblegum in his mouth, the humiliation of a spot on his chin, the unending turmoil of that endless struggle to stay afloat in a roiling sea of emotions, and the thousands of hours spent out on the gravel, determined to master an utterly valueless skill. The frisbee, the yo-yo, the hacky sack, the boomerang, in the unshakable belief that in this lay his salvation. Half of him battling to become visible, the other half just wanting to disappear. God, how had he ever endured it? A knock at the front door. Howard has lost track of time, but knows that it's late, hoping against hope. Hallie! He springs out of his chair to turn the latch. He ducks just in time to dodge the fist that comes flying out of the darkness. And in the village, the wind sets the lids of the wheelie bins chomping at nothing. And in the cinema, Hulk bounces and swings his fists. And in the video game shop, the Christmas games are in. And in Ed's, there's a special offer. 2 boxes of donuts for the price of 1. Someone says it's because of what happened, but someone else says no. Actually, they're doing it in all the branches. It doesn't matter where you go, though. Nowhere feels big enough to contain you. Even if you're right in the middle of the mall, it still somehow feels too shallow. Like when you were younger, and you tried to make your Transformers visit your Lego town, and they were just out of scale. It didn't work. It's like that. Or maybe it isn't, because you also feel really tinily small. You feel like a lump in somebody's throat, or actually who cares what you feel. And everywhere you go, you encounter other grey-clad boys from your year, looming up like hateful reflections. Gary Tulin, John Keating, Morris Wall, Vincent Bailey and all of the others that are the pinnacle of the evolution that began so many years ago with that one depressed fish. That if you met him now, you'd tell him to stay in the sea. There they are, pale-faced but smirking, sleeves rolled up. And though it's sad, it's sadder than a three-legged dog, it's also flat. It makes you angry. So when someone says Skippy was a homo, you're almost glad because you can fight them. And they're glad too. So you fight, until someone gets his jumper ripped or the security guard chases you out of the mall. And you've already been kicked out of the other mall. And it's too cold to go to the park. And you think it must be almost time to go to bed, but it's not. It's only just time for dinner, which is car tire with phlegm sauce, and which you leave mostly uneaten. And privately, you're thinking Skippy is a homo too. You're thinking, fuck you, Skippy. Though you're also thinking, hey, where's Skippy? Or, Skippy, did you borrow my... And then you think, oh, fuck. And everything shakes around the edges again. And you have to hold on tight to your lucky condom, or your 2-pack keyring, or your actual live shotgun bullet. Or if you don't have one of those things, wedge your hands deeper in your pockets, or throw a stone at a seagull, or shout after a knacker in the village how his mother was in excellent form last night, and run for it. And dream of being Hulk, or a Transformer in a Lego town going smash, bash, crash. Stomping the whole city to the ground, incinerating the little yellow-headed Lego people with your laser eyes, till the smiles melt right off their faces. And in the schoolyard, the lisp of a last fallen leaf, skating around the tarmac, is the only sound. Everywhere else is totally silent, even when people are talking. It's like someone's thrown a switch and reversed the polarity of everything, so that being alive now is like being dead. Like zombies. Grey bodies shuffling loose-limbed through the perpetual gloaming. Or like universes. Same difference. Matter or energy adrift in nothingness. Descending like veils through the darkness. Classes re-begin, but it doesn't make any difference. There is still that empty seat. And in maths class, calling the roll, Lurch goes,
Daniel J... Oh, no, of course not.
And scratches his name out. Right there in front of you. Farts go unpunished. Clear jinx situations unheeded. Pokemon cards unswapped. The junior rec room is deserted. The table tennis table folded up and tidied into a corner. The pool balls lined up in their perspex womb. The television, unprecedentedly, switched off. You don't talk about it. and you don't talk about not talking about it. And soon the not talking about it has become something real and tangible, existing among you. A hideous replacement Skippy, like an evil twin. A dark blastula that presses ever more insistently against your lives. The dormitory corridor presents only closed doors, behind which are closed faces, secreted beneath headphones or locked into mute dialogues with illuminated screens. Jeff hasn't done his zombie voice after the night in the ref had escaped without thinking,
"My roast beef needs more gravy,"
and sounded different from how it had before, louder than he meant it to be, and not funny, and even sort of frightening, like it knew something you didn't. And then one morning you go to your locker and find a note there from Ruprecht, calling you to an urgent meeting in his room. And even though it's probably bullshit, you find yourself climbing the tower stairs to his dorm. The others are already there, scrunched up on Ruprecht's bed, because no one wants to sit on Skippy's, even though his duvet is gone, as well as his other stuff. Ruprecht looks feverish and drawn. Ever since that night, in the middle of all this weird nothingness, he's been rushing about back and forth from his laboratory, one pen in his mouth and another behind his ear, stacks of paper and star maps and set squares bundled in his arms. He waits for everyone to sit down, and then he unscrolls a chart with a familiar shape drawn on it.
"The Van Doren portal Mark II,"
he says.
"Let me say at the outset that the science of this is far from being stable. This operation, if it works at all, will be highly dangerous. But by rebuilding the pod and recalibrating it to a monotemporal matrix, I have calculated that it might just be possible to travel backwards to a nodal point in time, e.g. the Halloween hop, and bring Skippy, as he was then, forward to the present. If we adjust the figures of the original teleportation for a temporal drag of..."
"Oh!" cries Dennis. Everyone turns to look at him. He is ice pale, breathing rapidly, and directing at Ruprecht a stare of unaccountable vehemence.
"What? Are you serious? I know it sounds far-fetched, but there is a small but real chance we could use the pod to rescue Skippy. In effect, we're doing the same thing we did with Optimus Prime, only with minor tweaks in order to..."
"Oh!" Dennis goes again. Ruprecht looks nonplussed. Dennis, in a single strange and complicated motion, throws his arms over his head, as if shielding it from a bomb blast, or as if it itself is about to explode, and then, springing up, marches out of the room. The others look around in bemusement. But before anyone has a chance to say anything, Dennis has marched back in, and thrusts something into Ruprecht's hands.
"Here!"
he shouts.
"Special delivery from the 11th dimension!"
"Optimus?"
Ruprecht turns the plastic robot over in wonderment. Then his gaze jabs upwards to Dennis.
"But how? I mean... where was he?"
"In my laundry basket underneath some Y-fronts,"
Dennis recites. Ruprecht is baffled.
"Some kind of wormhole?"
Dennis slaps a hand to his face, leaving a bright red mark.
"Oh my God! I put him there, Ruprecht. I put him there!"
"Phew."
Ruprecht trails off, his mouth becoming an anxious O, like a baby that has lost its soother.
"Don't you understand what I'm saying to you? Your pod doesn't work. It doesn't work! I took the robot. Your invention didn't do anything. Your inventions never do anything!"
"But..."
Ruprecht, increasingly distressed.
"The mound. And the music.
I made that up, moron. I made it all up. I thought it would be funny. And it was. It was really, really funny."
The others wince, sympathetically. Ruprecht very slowly doubles over, an expression of intense concentration on his face, as if he's drunk weed killer and is making a study of the effects. The sight of this makes Dennis only more ruthless.
"You know what your problem is, Blowjob? You're sure you're right. You're so sure you're right, you believe anything. You remind me of my crazy, god-bothering stepmother. All day long she casts her little spells. Jesus this, virgin that, sacred whatever. Say nine of these, sprinkle some of this on that, hey presto. She's so busy that she doesn't even notice that none of the things she prays for ever actually happens. She doesn't care whether they happen because all she wants really is something to let her walk around with her head in the clouds. And you're no different. Except with you, it's maths instead of prayers and gay universes and, oh yes, in case we forget, the aliens who are going to come down and build us a spaceship before the Earth goes pop.